I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. By all accounts, 74-year-old Robert Godwin was a well-loved family man who enjoyed fishing and collecting aluminum cans on the streets of Cleveland where he lived. On Sunday afternoon, Steve Stevens shot and killed him, a perfect stranger, and uploaded the video to his Facebook page. Stevens also went on Facebook Live for 2 hours that day in a disturbing and meandering rant until the video was pulled. He killed himself after being chased by police in Erie, Pennsylvania on Tuesday. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's CEO, spoke about this tragic and horrifying incident at the company's F8 conference this week.
We have a lot more to do here, and we're reminded of this this week by the tragedy in Cleveland. And our hearts go out to the family and friends of Robert Godwin Sr., and we have a lot of work, and we will keep doing all we can to prevent tragedies like this from happening.
Zuckerberg's vision for Facebook was a place to connect with friends and family, and while it is that, there's also a dark side to social media where you can watch crime and violence and where fake news has found a home. We asked Marianne Franks to join us. She's a professor of law at the University of Miami. She's got a forthcoming book, Enemies of the Constitution, Fanaticism in American Law and Politics. And Marianne Franks, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Emily Dreyfus, joining us by Skype, and she's senior staff writer at Wired. And Emily Dreyfus, nice to have you with us as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
And to our listeners, let me give you several ways to connect with the show. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. We're talking about the dark side of the web. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Emily, let me begin with you. Do we know how many people actually watched? There were actually three videos. One was Facebook Live, two videos that were uploaded. Do we know how many people watched these videos?
So we don't. I think it's probably helpful if we go through the timeline of what the videos were so that we have a baseline of understanding what happened. Steve Stevens uploaded a video that was not live. He recorded it and uploaded it. And in that video, he said he was going to kill people. No one flagged that video as inappropriate to Facebook. So nothing happened with it. About a little while later, a few minutes later, he uploaded a second video. That video showed him murdering the 74-year-old man.
Right.
That video also was not flagged right away. It was not flagged right away. I'm sorry. And then after that, he uploaded a Facebook Live video. And in that, he was talking to a friend and saying that he had just committed a bunch of murders. Now, that video got flagged in the middle of its broadcast. A little while later, the video of the murder got flagged. And at 23 minutes after Facebook was finally alerted, they removed the murder video. But that video was live for a little over 2 hours. Now, Facebook hasn't released how many people saw that video. However, when it was still live, I was looking at it, and I saw that at least 14,000 people had seen it. Now, you know, the thing is, you can extrapolate from there that thousands and thousands of more people saw it, because in that 2 hours and change that it was live on Facebook, it was able to be downloaded and re-uploaded to other sites where it now lives and proliferates across the web.
And I have to say, in preparation for this show, I did look at some of that video, so clearly it does live. Marianne Franks, we're going to get into a lot of legal issues here, but I also want to just read a tweet that the grandson of Mr. Godwin tweeted out on Sunday. He says, please, please, please stop retweeting that video and report anyone who has posted it. This is my grandfather. Show some respect. Hashtag Cleveland. I mean, this is a horrible and tragic incident that raises a whole host of questions, but here's a grandson pleading with Facebook users to do something, or certainly to stop viewing this video. Which I think, I'm at you, Marianne Franks, raises questions about the responsibility, yes, of Facebook, but also of users of Facebook as well. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, there's both the question of what Facebook helps unleash onto the public, and then there's the question of what can feasibly be done in the aftermath to try to limit some of the damage that is caused by it. And as we can tell from these types of pleas, you know we can probably both sympathize and empathize with the families and the people who are affected by this and understand why they're making those pleas to stop giving this more exposure, but we can also recognize immediately that this is going to be completely ineffective. Once a video like that is out there, once this type of footage has made its way into the public, there's really no way to get it back down. And one of the most frustrating things about Facebook's response, and not just in this case, but in previous cases, because this is by no means the first time
right.
we've seen this type of violent activity recorded or just distributed through Facebook. The frustrating thing about their response is that it's almost as though they're saying they're surprised every time, right? That, right. you know, this terrible thing has happened, we should really do better, but nothing fundamentally changes about the products or the platform that they're offering to the public. And it really does raise the question of, well, what exactly are you going to do, and why wasn't this something you thought about long before you ever made a product like Facebook Live available to the public?
Well, let me pick up on that. And we heard Mark Zuckerberg say there's a lot more we can do. And Emily, going back to you, as you say, this was up for 2 hours or so before it was pulled. Should is probably, yes, they should have, but could they have pulled this video before then?
Probably not. With the way that their system works right now, the system they have set up to remove a video like that takes time, and it depends on other Facebook users to recognize that something on the site is dangerous or criminal and to flag it. And once they flag it, that alert is sent to these humans that Facebook employs, you know, people all over the world, hundreds of thousands of people that they call content moderators, who, you know, are working in office buildings, making a low wage. They have a queue that they're looking at that is alerts that come from everyday people on Facebook. And when they see those alerts, they then watch each and every video to determine whether or not it should be taken down. So in this case, you know, the next day, Facebook released a timeline, and what they said was that no one flagged any of these videos until they'd been up for hours. Once they got that flag, it got sent to that queue, and 23 minutes later, someone took it down. Now, Facebook has since then, in that actually same statement where they released the timeline, they vowed, we will figure out how to make the system faster. That 23 minutes was unacceptable.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like what they're saying is it's really up to the users to police material that's on Facebook. There's something like 1.2 billion daily users of Facebook. Does that just overwhelm the system, Emily?
Sure. And there's a ton of content. And Facebook, you know, says we have too many videos and too many images that we could employ humans to be looking at all of them. We need to rely on our community. Now, a lot of people say that that's Facebook abdicating responsibility and putting it on the community and refusing to admit that Facebook itself needs to be an arbiter and a decider, to use a strange word, of what gets to be on Facebook. But the thing is, there's like this magic sauce, third heat that people want to include in this process, and that is artificial intelligence. People want, you know, technologists want, and Facebook wants, and Facebook users want that process of flagging to be automated by a computer, so that that first video that Steve Stevens uploaded where he said that he was going to go out and kill people, no human saw that because he didn't have enough friends to be watching. Nobody was watching. Ideally, in an ideal scenario, an algorithm, a smart intelligence computer would have seen that, would have understood those words to be a direct, real threat, flagged it with the highest possible priority, and sent that to the queue of the humans in the Philippines whose job it is to take a video down. Now, that would be the better way to do this. And people are calling for it. However, the reason why it doesn't work like that right now is that artificial intelligence despite what technologists say about it, it's not actually ready or capable or smart enough to do that.
And that puts the onus back on Facebook. Marianne Franks, what responsibility then do you think Facebook has? As Zuckerberg has said, this is, you know, we want to create a community where people can share information about themselves. And clearly most people do that without some kind of criminal or violent intent. But what is the responsibility of Facebook under circumstances that we're talking about?
Well, I guess it depends on whether we're talking about their legal responsibilities versus what I guess we could call their ethical responsibilities. And the legal area is a lot grayer, or at least maybe less forthcoming when it comes to issues like this, because there's a lot of protections that we afford to platforms like Facebook to keep them from being held legally accountable for the content that's provided by users. But as an ethical matter, it really does seem striking, as this conversation is showing, that if we have this possibility or this belief that artificial intelligence is what's going to make it possible for this product to be, on balance, less harmful than more harmful, then if Facebook doesn't have it yet, if that's not something they're prepared to do or have ready to go, then it seems like that should have been a conversation before they made certain decisions about how their platform was going to operate. We're kind of trapped right now, to some extent, in this world that social media companies have made for us. And of course, we've helped them make it, but all of this that we're dealing with now, this billions of pieces of content, this instantaneous transmission of the best and the worst of humanity, these are all choices that were made. This is not a state of nature that we're in. These are choices that the technology industry has made. And now it seems that when that technology inevitably is used for really dark or evil purposes, the people who are responsible for creating the possibility for this to go viral, for it to be a spectacle, back up and say, well, we really didn't know what to do with that. And that's such a striking lack of reflection on what they're unleashing onto the public. And it's not something that happened just this year or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. It starts right at the beginning of the development of many of these products and platforms, and just this lack of concern or awareness for the fact that these products were going to be used in harmful fashion.
About a minute before our first break, Marianne, let me go back to you. Are you saying to Facebook then, you must invest in this artificial intelligence so we will have some of this tools and technology to deal with the misuse of the web?
Well, it's quite clear that Facebook is willing to do that to the extent that it can. It's doing that right now with non-consensual pornography and trying to use photo matching technology to automate this process and take certain types of objectionable material down. But I think that's still sort of a late question. The earlier question still needs to be, if this product is not something that we can contain, then maybe the product, for instance, Facebook Live, never should have been rolled out, at least until we could figure out what to do. But it may just be the case that instantaneous, moderation-free content is just not something that anything can actually get a handle on, not AI or anything else.
I want to pick up on that after this short break. That's Marianne Franks. She's a professor of law at the University of Miami. As I mentioned, author of a forthcoming book called Enemies of the Constitution, Fanaticism in American Law and Politics. Also with us, Emily Dreyfus, joining us by Skype. And she's a senior staff writer at Wired. And we've been talking about this just horribly tragic case, the murder of an elderly gentleman, a 74-year-old man in Cleveland named Robert Godwin, killed by a stranger, Steve Stevens. It was uploaded on his Facebook page, also went on Facebook Live, I should say, for a couple of hours. And we're talking about the dark side of the web and what to do about it. And again, we want to hear from you. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about Steve Stevens' horrifying Facebook posts this week, including the murder of a 74-year-old man, and it has raised a whole host of questions, including social media responsibility, whether it involves crime, violence, or fake news, whether it's the users or whether it's a large organization like Facebook. Again, talking with Emily Dreyfus and Mary Ann Franks. Emily, is it different talking about Facebook Live versus talking about posting things on Facebook technology-wise?
Yeah, it is. It's a subtle difference. But, you know, with videos that are uploaded, it is potentially easier for the AI to monitor. With a video that is live, right now Facebook doesn't have it on any sort of delay. And so there's no way for its system to know what's coming. And additionally, it also just the real-time nature of the video, I think, has a potential psychological impact, and could, you know, we were talking earlier about how technology can kind of shape culture in ways that it either doesn't intend or isn't aware of. And with a live video, there is some potentially very strong encouragement to the person uploading it to do something exciting.
Saying to themselves, oh, this is something worth watching.
Yeah.
Is there also, I was reading about something called the bystander effect, which is a kind of apathy that can overcome someone, or not overcome someone, but can, in a sense, go into effect where they're observing something and they don't offer to help or they don't offer to intervene. Is that, do you think that's a piece of what we're talking about here? And then I'd like to put a couple of questions to you, Marianne Franks, but to you, Emily Dreyfuss.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. And, you know, the bystander effect happens in real life, but it can be, like all things, amplified online, especially when you're watching a video from who knows where, so far away from the person who is uploading it, that physical distance can make you feel much less responsible for doing anything about it. As well as the fact that you may think, well, lots of other people are watching, and one of them will do the thing. There are two parts to that I think are really interesting for us to consider about how this technology can work. One is that Facebook could actively try to mitigate the bystander effect by making subtle visual design cues more obvious to people watching video. As a reminder, they could make the ability to flag something that is damaging more obvious so that people who are watching something, as they are seeing a crime or something violent happen on a video, in their vision, in their line of vision, is the option to flag it. Right now, those alerts and options and settings are very much hidden. And that is because Facebook does not want to have all of us, as we're looking at videos of our grandchildren and friends on Facebook, having in the back of our mind this thought that the world is a dangerous place and something dangerous could happen. So they don't make it obvious, but that can contribute to the bystander effect. Additionally, the other thing is that online, the sharing of information is itself a kind of currency, and Facebook knows that because it encourages us to share as much as we can and get positive or negative feedback after we do so. And it's not just the sharing of our own personal information, but, you know, we're living in a culture where you get credit if you're the first one to say something. You know, that's, you know, Facebook's not alone here. Twitter exists like that. If you go on Twitter on any given day when news is breaking, people are all competing and jumping and falling all over themselves to be the first person to say something. And that's because there's a little bit of cachet in being the one to share it. And that can contribute to the bystander effect as well, because what we do not necessarily do is value the person who flags or alerts, but we do value the person who shares. So, you know, to go back to your original question of Robert Godwin's grandson saying, please don't share this video of my grandfather. Think about the fact that he's a human being. Don't share it. You know, as Marianne said, that's a losing battle, because on social media, we're encouraged to share.
Well, let me go to you, Marianne. And I'm thinking, if all of this had taken place, let's say, on the streets of Cleveland, and Steve Stevens was saying these things out loud, and even perhaps, I mean, even committing the murder, which he obviously did. But if all this was happening, I guess, in the analog world, how would it be different? And would there be different laws about intervention?
Well, many things potentially could have gone differently if he had been surrounded by people who were concerned about him, were taking what he was saying seriously. I'm not particularly optimistic about what kind of response he would have gotten, because we see, for instance, domestic violence incidents, other forms of violence every day, where there's plenty of red flags and signs in the real world, and frankly, not even not just bystanders or people around the person who might be committing these acts, but even law enforcement tends to turn a blind eye. So I think the story is pretty grim no matter where we look at it. But one thing that I think we do need to think about, as Emily is referring to, is the way in which the social media itself is pushing us to do certain things. And that isn't to say that, you know, Facebook causes these types of crimes, but there's certainly an element of performance in a lot of these really horrific incidents. So we can't forget the fact that what he's saying on this video and what he's saying right in the moments before he's slaughtering this person is that this is about a woman, and he's saying her name, and he's saying this is something, he's doing this as a way to communicate to her and about her. And that's something that you really can't extricate, at least from what happened in this particular instance, nor is it something we can extricate from the gang rapes that are clearly partly broadcast for people to see them and to like them, like in both the Facebook sense and in another sense. And so there's at least some of these crimes, the teenagers who were torturing that disabled teen, these are performances. And there's something about Facebook and something about social media generally that is encouraging people to act on their impulses in ways that they might not have acted had it not been for the fact that there was a certain type of validation that they were going to get, and as Emily was saying, a validation and sharing it as quickly as possible.
Let me just add something else, and this is not so much about the technology or people using Facebook, but the former girlfriend of Steve Stevens apparently met with a couple of the daughters of Godwin, and they, I'm quoting here, they hugged, they cried, they prayed together. The children of Godwin said to Steve Stevens, when, I guess when he was on the loose, "We forgive you." I mean, these are just, you know, incredible moments of humanity while we're talking about all the sort of dark side of the web. And I just don't want that part of the conversation to get lost. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Marcia says, "Perhaps off topic, but also reprehensible, local news platforms broadcast footage of moments before the shooting murder of Robert Godwin Sr." So, Emily, it's, I mean, yes, we're focusing on the web. We're focusing on Facebook, Facebook Live, things like that. But it's, that's not the only place where people are documenting what's going on in the world.
Yeah, of course. So that, I think that gets to something really interesting about the way in which media and broadcasting in general has changed as a result of social media. You know, Facebook, Twitter, all of these platforms, Instagram, Periscope, what they do is take out the middleman. They take out you and me. There is no journalist anymore deciding what is newsworthy and what can be shown. And that is the extreme power of social media. We have seen it for good. You know, I reported on the Standing Rock protests when the only people there were the actual protesters streaming live on Facebook Live and alerting the world to it. So there is a grand utility in doing this. However, when they do that, by doing that, they remove the kind of guidelines and like years of ethical study that we journalists have done to decide what is appropriate and what isn't. Now, what I think your commenter Marcia is getting at is that traditional media is actually, I think, in some ways being also changed by the fact of social media, because if the video of Robert Godwin's murder had been sent only to traditional broadcast outlets, they may have decided to show none of it,
right,
because of the trauma of it, and it may have been against their guidelines. However, by not having the opportunity to make that choice, when Steve Stevens uploaded it directly, it was already seen throughout the world, and that made the video itself newsworthy and perhaps more acceptable to be shown on these outlets than it otherwise would have been. And that's something that, you know, we as a society and we as journalists need to grapple with. Yeah.
It's okay. You heard me take a big breath there. Let me just reintroduce you. That's Emily Dreyfuss, senior writer at Wired. Also with us, Marianne Franks, professor of law at the University of Miami. And again, we are talking about the use or misuse of social media, Facebook in particular. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Marianne, a couple of things to you. I was reading that something like 60% of Americans get their news from social media, which is very sobering for people like myself, and I'm sure like Emily as well. And also, I saw a quote about or from Zuckerberg saying that Facebook Live is like having a TV camera in your pocket. Anyone with a phone now has the power to broadcast to anyone in the world. When you interact live, you feel connected in a more personal way. This is a big shift in how we communicate. It's going to create new opportunities for people to come together. Do you think he's being naive there?
I guess the word I would use is not exactly naive. I think that it reflects a very specific approach to the world. And it's an approach to the world that says powerful products that could be used in all kinds of different ways are going to be good because the way that I live my life is tells me or reassures me that I really won't be on the receiving end of whatever bad might come of it. And that's my delicate way of saying that the tendency on the part of many of the decision makers in tech is to not think about the people who could be harmed by these types of things. I mean, if you take, I would just guess, the average woman, and you tell her the same thing about how there's going to be a possibility that everybody is going to have a camera in their pocket, and isn't that wonderful? And you might get a very different response from her about how she thinks that's going to affect her life. So even before we talk about violence and gruesome killings, we should talk about the fact that having a camera in your pocket at all times and the possibility to make everything around you into a spectacle, and note that there's nothing in Zuckerberg's statement about consent. There's nothing about saying you want to make sure that everybody around you is aware of the fact that they're about to become, you know, actors in your little movie. So it's a very shockingly insulated view of the world, and a kind of a shockingly entitled sense of the world to say, let's give everybody these tools to make other people essentially subjects to our own fantasies. And so there's just something really surprising, that is to say, either that we're not thinking about here or that we're dismissing, that implicit in Zuckerberg's statement here is a dismissal of the kinds of bad things that are inevitably going to happen, which are probably going to impact negatively the same people that it has always impacted, women, minorities, sexual minorities, people who don't necessarily have the same types of power or entitlement as other people in society. So one of the mistakes here, I think, is in this rush to embrace certain forms of technology, is that we're only looking at a tiny subset of people who really don't have that many concerns about the misuses of this technology, instead of asking the people who very well might see further down the road.
But are you saying, Marianne, there's always, it seems like technology always opens these questions, important questions for discussion. But broadly speaking, if there are 1.2 billion users of Facebook, can we say that most of them, the large majority of them, are using it as intended?
Well, I think it really raises the question of what we mean by intended, because if what is really going on, and we have to remember that Facebook has become so powerful now, powerful more, you could argue, than, let's say, a government, and yet it has no real accountability. So when we say that it's being used as intended, well, it's a corporation, so its intent is to make more money. And if that's the measure by which we're looking at this, well, it's doing really well.
Right.
But if we're looking at it for something else, then that's exactly why it becomes difficult to talk about, because since they're not, strictly speaking, a media outlet and they're not a government agency, they're this corporation, well, what exactly do we expect them to do? And when do we say that they're being successful? Is it just in terms of the sheer numbers of people who use their product, or the number or the amount of profits that they make, or is it something else? And I hope that incidents like this most recent one push us to say, well, it's got to be a little bit more than just whether or not Facebook is profitable.
Let me play a phone call that we got to our comment line, and this is Frank.
Frank, Philadelphia. I believe the use of the websites and the Facebook and all of that to prevent crime is virtually impossible. The gap between the time somebody places something on Facebook about doing harm and the system or anyone to prevent something like that is virtually impossible. We have to accept that the medium of Facebook, Twitter, etc. is both good and very dangerous, and buyer beware.
Emily Dreyfus, he says, Facebook and Twitter, both good and very dangerous, or very dangerous, and buyer beware. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty succinct way of putting it. And I think his point that, you know, for us to assume that we can have law enforcement or Facebook itself policing these videos and actually prevent a crime is really highly unlikely. What we should be focusing on preventing is the subtle ways in which these platforms may encourage certain kinds of crime, on the one hand, and on the other hand, finding ways to discourage the sharing of this content, because the sharing and exposure to violence like this is itself traumatic. And I think that is the place that Facebook can really actually do better. I don't think that there's anyone who would say Facebook could have stopped Steve Stevens for murdering Robert Godwin. What they would like for Facebook to find a way to do is to have stopped that video from being seen unintentionally by thousands of people.
And, I mean, do you think users... sounds like he actually killed this man, and then he went on Facebook Live after the fact, so there was really no way to prevent the murder. But do you think under different circumstances, Emily Dreyfuss, that users could have stepped in and made a difference?
Yeah, and there have been cases like, you know, I mean, a lot of people have, so many people have been uploading videos of themselves committing suicide on Facebook that Facebook has now instigated suicide warnings and suicide prevention outreach. And in, you know, in lots of those cases, when people are watching, they are calling the police and saying, I'm watching something that is about to happen. You need to stop and do something. So we as humans can do it.
Let me read an email from Nash. I'll put this to you, Marianne. Nash says, stop bashing. Facebook Live helps average people film police brutality. And we certainly have had incidents of that as well. Marianne?
I think that's an extraordinary bit of half logic, right? Because what's amazing about that perspective, and that it, this is brought up a lot, is say, oh, Facebook Live does all these good things. You need to stop criticizing it. Well, if you will credit Facebook Live with doing good in the world, if you think that there is something powerful about its platform of this product to shine a light on a certain activity, that's certainly true. It can certainly be used for those things. But then why is it that as soon as it's used for bad purposes, suddenly Facebook doesn't have anything to do with it? I think we have to just recognize the fact that if Facebook Live is valuable, then it is also very dangerous. And then we have to work from there. Given the fact that it can be used for both good and evil, as many, many tools can, the question is then how much bad is Facebook really willing to tolerate? And is it willing to really take stock of the fact that it's helped create the very society that is encouraging people to do incredibly horrific and terrible things, balanced as against, I think, fairly modest results in terms of what it's done good for the world?
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Marianne Franks joining us along with Emily Dreyfuss. And you can join us as well. We are talking about the dark side of the web. Call or text our comment line 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about the ways that Facebook and other social media platforms can mitigate harmful activity on the web, talking with Emily Dreyfuss, senior staff writer at Wired, and Marianne Franks, professor of law at the University of Miami. Emily, I have a text for you from a listener. How was Emily alerted to the video before the people whose job it was to monitor? You mentioned this at near the top of the hour.
That's the thing. It was being shared around. Many, many people had seen it. And I think I came upon it because of a hashtag. And, you know, my job is also to monitor social media and breaking news. And it was news, in the social world. And this is something, you know, in the new way that the world works, we journalists monitor Facebook Live and we monitor Twitter for things that are happening, because often that's where people talk about it first. And even in Cleveland, people in Cleveland were sharing the video around to warn each other that there was a killer on the loose, because Steve Stevens was saying in the video that he had killed 13 people. Cleveland police have found absolutely no evidence that there were any other victims besides the man that he killed on the video. But, you know, that's really kind of points to the problem here, is that these videos are able to be downloaded and shared before anyone on Facebook's end has monitored them.
And from what we know, no one called the cops.
I can't speak to that. I'm not sure. I do not know.
Let me read some more comments. One from a listener. Facebook is a public platform, not a private entity. It has been, can be, and will be exploited. Frankly, our actual public spaces are exploited this way. This isn't exclusively the problem of the Internet. A text from Lee. I'd like to see social media companies provide funding for education in schools on how to maintain and support an ethically responsible Internet presence. That would be good. Facebook from David. Facebook, a non living entity, has no heart, no feelings, and cannot act as if it does. Let me turn to you, Marianne Franks. We've been focusing largely on these horrific crimes and acts of violence that have been posted on sites like Facebook. But I'm also thinking about fake news. As I mentioned earlier, something like 60% of Americans get their news from social media. And it's also a place where fake news has found a home and seems to thrive. Do you see this as connected?
These are certainly connected. I mean, when we're trying to take stock of the issues that this rapidly changing world of technology, the issues that it presents for us, it isn't just these hopefully outlier cases of horrific violence. It's also the daily habits that all of us are developing and the daily habits that we're taking on that are making us, I think, on balance, a lot less informed and a lot less thoughtful and a lot less reflective. And all of that is tied up with the impulses, I think, that social media, including Facebook, but certainly not limited to Facebook, the impulses that they are encouraging. In other words, I mean, we are now in a political climate where it's quite clear that the best way to characterize it would be impulsive, right? That we react to things, that there isn't a lot of time for research, there's not a lot of respect or time afforded to people who actually take moments to think through an issue, research an issue, as opposed to reacting to an issue. And so when you have Facebook taking over people's lives in the way that it kind of has, that many people, as you say, are getting their news from Facebook, it's the only place where they're learning about the world. Given the way that Facebook works, that means that what they could be looking at pretty much all the time is utter nonsense. And they think that they've learned the truth. They spent 3 hours on Facebook. They think they know something about the world. And I think what we've lost sight of is if we're going to really take seriously the claims that technology is democratizing, that it's helping us all access information that we wouldn't have had before, all the great idealism that was being shouted from the rooftops in the 90s,
right.
Well, we really need to take some objective measures of, well, is it true that since the rise of Facebook, we've become smarter as a population, less impulsive, more knowledgeable, more patient, more kind, more anything? Because if the answer is no, then I think we really need to be asking that existential question about our social media. What good is it doing us?
Well, Emily, and I'm old enough to remember that a time before Facebook and before the internet, and I do remember those early idealistic days about, and I think there's some truth to this, that the internet connects us to the world. It allows us to have access to, frankly, an entire universe of information. And I do think that is still true, but it also has allowed us to kind of find our niche within that world and create our own kind of reality.
I mean, I think that's fair. You know, I as well remember the era before the internet and before social media.
Typewriters and things like that, yes.
Yes, and you know, I think that it is easy to overstate how different, you know, filter bubbles online are as opposed to offline. People have always sorted themselves by interest and, you know, surrounded themselves with people of like mind. And I think that it's not that the internet invented this problem. The internet exploited this side of human nature. Now, one thing I think is, you know, a really fair criticism on the internet, as you brought up, is that the ethos in Silicon Valley that not necessarily is what created the internet, because Tim Berners-Lee was not in Silicon Valley when he created it, but that has made it what it is, the modern internet as we understand it. The ethos is move fast and break stuff. Come up with the technology, put it out there in the world and see what happens. And that is, you know, antithetical to approaching social issues like this with a reasoned, thoughtful approach, which is what Marianne was talking about. You know, of course, can we look back at the 20 years that we've been using this kind of medium and say, has it made the world a better place? And if the answer is no, maybe we need to do some soul searching and change it. That is absolutely true. But, you know, perhaps the better model would be to do that soul searching before we ever put it out there. But
it's too late for that, isn't it? I mean, here we are.
Sure, but, you know, we're going to be creating new technologies every single day. You know, we are really at the beginning of what, like, neural networks and AI are going to be able to do. And even, you know, this week, as Facebook was saying this week that it was going to try to figure out how to go back and make Facebook Live and video on Facebook a safe environment, at the exact same time that it was making those kind of boilerplate statements, it was also at its F8 developers conference unveiling all of this new artificial reality technology, including the fact that it revealed that it has 60 people working on a way to embed Facebook directly into your brain with a neural chip.
I knew that was coming, right?
Right. So that rather than typing a Facebook status or even hitting send to upload a video, you can think a thought and it will automatically go onto Facebook. Now, you know, that is absurd, crazy, ridiculous, and also probably something that will happen in the near future. And so, you know, I think what we as a society, not Facebook, as Marianne was saying, you know, they're a corporation. Their responsibility is to their bottom line. We as a society need to say, wait, we don't want you, I mean, if this is the case, if we don't want them to put things out there before they're fully baked and ready to be used responsibly, that is on us to figure out how do we regulate it? Is there a way, and I'd love to hear what Marianne thinks about this, you know, is there a way that we could create laws that would make Facebook have to operate in the responsible manner that we as a society could agree is appropriate? And I don't know. I think that's a very hard question, but one I'd love to hear Marianne answer.
Sure, me as well. Laws or regulations, or whether it's a matter of developing a kind of ethos about the internet. And of course, you're talking about billions of people around the world. Are there laws, Marianne, or regs?
Well, there could be. The problem is that we are looking at decades now of tech exceptionalism. We have created a world in which we have said about the internet and social media generally that we really want to see what you're going to do. So we're going to do this hands-off regulatory approach starting in the 1990s. And effectively what that model did was it said to companies like Facebook, do whatever you want and whatever benefits you get, you know, you get to be credited with those. And we're going to talk about how great this is for democracy. And to the extent that bad things happen, you will not be held accountable. And that's quite literally written into the law in Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that effectively says that when you are an intermediary online and you are facilitating content from third-party users, that you really can't be held accountable for the terrible things they do.
Hmm.
But, of course, at the same time, Facebook and other companies will take credit for, you know, the benefits that they presumably provide for society. Now, we've gone down that road so far, it's really difficult to know what we can do about it now. But that, I think, was our first mistake, was in thinking that technology should be treated so much differently from any other product, because this is not how we deal with medicine. This is not how we would deal with vehicles or other products. We don't just say, just see what happens, and if a bunch of people die, get back to us, and we'll try to figure it out. So what we really have to undo is that thinking, the mentality behind, oh, we have to keep our regulations out of the internet because, you know, we need to make sure that it flourishes. Well, it has flourished, and it has flourished in some pretty dark and nefarious ways. So I think at a minimum, we need to take the laws that we have and try to use them with a little bit more seriousness, because there is still some room, even in that regulation that I just mentioned, the CDA Section 230, which makes exceptions, for instance, for things like copyright violations. So one of the things that's been pointed out in light of this most recent event is that Facebook's pretty quick to take down copyright infringing material, not as quick to take down rapes and murders. Now, that should give all of us pause. But one possible answer is that in the federal law itself, Facebook doesn't get to say, you can't hold me accountable for copyright infringement, because that law doesn't give them the power to say that. So we made a choice. Our law has made a choice that copyright's really important, but all this other stuff, rape threats or revenge porn or whatever it might be, that's less important. So we probably need to do some rethinking about that, or at least try to read, because all laws can be read in at least, you know, more than one way. Courts need to be doing maybe a more robust job of saying, look, Section 230 doesn't mean you can't ever hold these entities accountable. Sometimes you certainly can.
Well, this is not a perfect analogy, but do we hold Toyota responsible if someone drives drunk in their Toyota?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious answer there is no, but is that the analogy, right? If someone is using Facebook Live to broadcast their sexual assault or their murder, they are technically using Facebook in exactly the way that Facebook is encouraging everyone to use it. Make sure that everybody becomes a witness to your life. That's essentially what Facebook Live is telling people to do and Facebook is pushing people to do. So it's not as though we're using it. It's not like you're trying to take a can opener and use it as, you know, a
knife,
lawnmower, right? Right, for instance. I mean, it's not a misuse use of a product in that sense. It's, in fact, just encouraging people. The product itself is encouraging you to use it in certain ways. So I think, at least at a minimum, we have to ask the question, if we're willing to say, look, Facebook does have legal responsibility when it comes to copyright infringements, and it has legal responsibilities when it comes to child pornography, why is it that those are the only few categories that we are willing to say, yeah, you've got to take some sort of ownership of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, those are all good points, and we could go down that road. Let me read some more comments that we've gotten. One, a text from Mark. He says, this is not as new as it may seem. I can still remember the image of Lee Harvey Oswald being murdered by Jack Ruby live on TV. An email from Gayton. Do your guests think that in today's society that there's any correlation between the video game mentality and people streaming live video of terrible acts like this? One from Max. It's up to all of us to stop retweeting and sharing video from the dark side of the web. Let me pick up the first one, and I'll toss this to you, Emily, about seeing, and again, I remember seeing this as well, seeing on television Lee Harvey Oswald being murdered by Jack Ruby, also in Pennsylvania. This was a couple of decades ago. The Pennsylvania State Treasurer, Bud Dwyer, he shot himself live on TV at a press conference. So there are some interesting parallels having to do with television.
Yeah, and, Facebook did not invent the urge for humans to broadcast terrible acts and to gain notoriety from it. We've seen that lots of times. People send, terrible things to news organizations, and those two examples are perfect in an attempt to get attention. However, we've seen, there was in the 70s, a newscaster committed suicide on air, and it was the first time that had ever happened. And it was live, and so there was nothing the broadcasters could do to stop it. However, they then made a decision after that moment to lock down the tape and never show it again. And that is something that right now with the system with Facebook is unable to do. It's live, but they give that video is able to be downloaded by anyone. So whether or not, Facebook takes it down, it's too late. It's already been downloaded and uploaded to Live Leak, where people who are really into watching violent videos are able to see it. So there are changes like that. And those examples of earlier times when people sought notoriety by sending this kind of material to broadcasters, it resulted in regulation from society. We have the 7-minute delay or 7-second delay on live broadcast TV for a reason. And we have rules about what is able to be shown on TV and what isn't. And, I think that is perhaps the opportunity here to figure out how does regulation play a role in catching up with social media's ability to broadcast this kind of content.
And we're just about out of time. Let me read two more emails. So we could have spent an hour on these. An email from Matthew. Would we expect AI to know the video of Steve Stevens killing a man should be pulled down, but the video of a Minnesota police officer killing Philando Castile should not because of the legitimate public interest? ? Also from Ernie. I'm shocked at how easily we are shifting blame from our own culpability to Facebook. Tens of thousands of human beings viewed that video. How many flagged it or brought it to the attention of Facebook? All good questions. We have to end our discussion. Emily Dreyfus, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior staff writer at Wired, and she joined us by Skype. Marianne Franks, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And she's a professor of law at the University of Miami. She's got a book coming out called Enemies of the Constitution, Fanaticism in American Law and Politics. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can also look at our Facebook Live post of earlier this week of all of us doing yoga. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those questions as well.